scandal in the aid sector today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Oxfam is a global leader when it comes to humanitarian relief, but some of its employees now stand accused of sexual abuse and prostituting victims of disaster.
If you want to find one sector in the world that has some of the grossest power imbalances, it would have to be humanitarian aid.
Plus, there is a big push for offshore wind power in Britain, but Brexit could wreck it.
You know, we are in a global supply chain. If there is a significant change there, well, that means extra cost, extra documentation, and perhaps hassle as well.
And a city in Kenya gets a special screening of Black Panther.
It was Hollywood red carpet meets African elegance.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We've all been practically numbed by the wave of sexual scandal since Weinstein, but this new one is hard to get your head around. It involves a humanitarian aid group. These are organizations that are supposed to help people in the most dire need and actually might have ended up doing them harm. In the last few days, the aid group Oxfam has been hit by such allegations. Officials from Oxfam are accused of prostituting survivors of humanitarian disasters in Haiti and in Chad and possibly elsewhere. The problem of sexual abuse in the humanitarian aid community is bigger than just one organization, but there are people actively working to prevent it.
Let's sit down. Let's find ways to stop putting the responsibility on women for their own safety. We know that there are survivors out there, and we know that the best systems and policies are the ones that are guided by and designed by survivors.
That's veteran aid worker Heidi Lehman. She'll be featured in an upcoming series on The World that looks at sexual harassment and abuse in the humanitarian aid sector. Amy Costello, senior correspondent and investigations editor at the Nonprofit Quarterly, is a reporter on the series. I asked Amy about the charges at the root of the Oxfam scandal.
We all remember the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. The allegations are that Oxfam's country director for Haiti used prostitutes at a villa that had been rented for him by Oxfam in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. There are also reports that this country director and another man had both worked in Chad prior to going to Haiti, and that when they were in Chad, there were similar concerns raised about their behavior there. And yet, even after that, they were given these senior roles in Haiti. There are also allegations that underage girls may have been involved in this incident in Haiti, but Oxfam says those allegations about the age of the girls or women are unproven.
So the spotlight right now is on Oxfam, but how unique are they in the world of humanitarian NGOs when it comes to this?
Well, I think we're about to find out. Even just today, the aid group Doctors Without Borders announced that it had acted on 24 cases of harassment or sexual abuse in the last year. And I think we may hear similar organizations coming forward with what they know about sexual abuse and harassment in their organizations. But Marco, I just think it's important to point out that this is indeed an issue that has been going on in the humanitarian sector for decades. Ever since the UN sent peacekeepers to Cambodia in the 90s, there have been allegations of sexual abuse among UN peacekeepers. I've reported on some of that for your own program in the past decade or so. In West Africa in 2002, there was widespread sexual abuse of children by relief workers. They were in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and they were asked to give sexual favors in return for things like school fees. And then even just in November of last year, the UN reported 31 new allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation against peacekeepers and civilians working for UN agencies in just a three-month period.
It's pretty extraordinary. Why, though? I mean, these are organizations that are supposed to help people, not to harm people.
Something that we've been learning in light of the Me Too movement is that sexual abuse and harassment is often about power differentials. And if you want to find one sector in the world that has some of the grossest kind of power imbalances, it would have to be humanitarian aid. You have aid workers going into places that are in crisis, where there is oftentimes not enough food, not enough water, inadequate shelter. And you have populations that are desperate and not empowered. And so we have an environment that is simply ripe for sexual abuse and exploitation. It's also, I think, very important to say, however, that the vast majority of aid workers out there are likely doing very important work, not exploiting local populations. But it is indeed a sector that is ripe for this kind of exploitation to occur. And when you think about reporting, You know, who's going to report?
And we've got to remember, too, that many of these aid groups are doing really important work. And often a lot of that work is done by women, often women of color from developing countries. So what could be the consequences for them if budgets for humanitarian groups start getting slashed?
It's a very important point to remember about who is doing aid work across the globe. And the allegations about Oxfam involve so-called expat or international staff. But the fact of the matter is the majority of people doing important work across the globe are people of color from developing nations, as you say, many of them women, taking risks and to be in places that are unsafe, delivering vital life-saving care. And so I do think it's important to remember that as we begin to critique the sector, as we rightfully should, how these allegations will impact the bottom line of these organizations, what it means for their staff who are indeed doing good work around the world, and what that means for, you know, humanitarian settings going forward.
Amy, this is very much on your mind because you're working on a series for The World on sexual harassment and abuse in humanitarian aid work. What are the kinds of stories that you're looking at?
You know, it's kind of a very in-depth analysis of the inherent problems that exist in the sector that prevent aid workers from feeling safe doing their work and what can be done to make them feel more safe. It has a lot to do with what we're talking about today.
And for our series, you've actually already spoken with a veteran aid worker, Heidi Lehman. She's also a consultant who focuses on ending violence against women and girls, especially in these humanitarian settings. I'd like us to hear what she had to tell you about what she sees as the way forward.
Let's get survivors around the table feeding into these systems. Let's have a frank discussion about risk management. I think that there should be much more attention to this. I think that attention has to turn into action. I think the heads of organizations need to take this on 110%.
So Amy Costello, Heidi was saying the heads of organizations need to take this on 110%. Fair enough. But will the women who often don't have a voice, will they be up for this?
I think ever since the Harvey Weinstein story broke, we have an answer to that, which is that indeed women are becoming more emboldened than ever to come forward and speak truthfully about their experiences in sectors across the globe. And I don't think the humanitarian aid sector will be any different.
Amy Costello, senior correspondent and investigations editor at the Nonprofit Quarterly, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Amy has already heard from a number of aid workers about their experiences with sexual harassment and abuse, and she would like to hear from more of you. You can call us at 857-285-4157 and leave a confidential message. Amy will be personally checking the inbox for your comments. Again, that number, 857-285-4157. If you missed that, the number is also on our website, pri.org/womenslives. And thanks. Oxfam is based in the United Kingdom, so what kind of impact is this emerging scandal having in Britain? The World's Leo Hornack joins us from our studio at the BBC in London. What is the impact, Leo?
It's huge, Marco. I mean, to give you a bit of a sense, this story has pushed the Olympics off the front pages for the past 4 days.
Wow.
And that's because Oxfam is more than just any other charity in Britain. I mean, it's one of the largest charities in this country. If you walk down any high street in any town in Britain, there'll be a charity shop, and the chances are that charity shop will be an Oxfam shop. There's one that's just 20 yards away from where I live. So it kind of goes to the heart of what people think about charities and the trust that they put into charities. And there is a sense that I think a backlash has already begun. You've had celebrity disendorsements, the British film star Minnie Driver. She was a kind of celebrity ambassador for Oxfam, has been for 20 years. She's formally disassociated herself. And Oxfam themselves have said that they've had 1,200 people cancel their recurring donations over the weekend. And that's twice as many as they'd usually expect in that period. So, yeah, this is a big deal in this country.
Yeah, you mentioned those charity shops on the main streets throughout England. I mean, those secondhand stores are basically the Salvation Army of the UK. Oxfam just has a really high trust factor. What is Oxfam saying in response to this scandal?
Well, I mean, as always with this kind of scandal, it's the scandal itself and then the perception of a cover-up. And both of those can be equally toxic to an organization's public image. So on the one hand, we know much more now about what happened in Haiti, but it's also emerging that Oxfam feels it didn't fulfill its obligations after the fact. So the deputy chief executive of Oxfam, Penny Lawrence, she stepped down. She said she was ashamed of the way that that scandal was handled. She said she took full responsibility. And as I think you've heard already on today's program, there's a wider sense that this was not necessarily an isolated incident or isolated to Oxfam. So there's been talk of this being just the tip of the iceberg in terms of abusive behavior happening in the international aid industry.
Now, the British government is a major source of funding for Oxfam, not to mention other international charities. What are they saying?
Well, that's going to be the biggest practical impact probably in the short term. I mean, Oxfam gets 43% of its funding from public authorities and the government. So in terms of what Oxfam is, in a very real sense, Oxfam exists because of the British taxpayer. And this is where the government has really pushed things. The minister concerned, she's called Penny Mordaunt, she has said she's concerned at the fact that Oxfam was lacking moral leadership. And she's made an explicit threat to withdraw funding or reduce government funding from Oxfam if they fail to get their story basically straight. But more importantly than that, we're already beginning to see this widening out to other charities that are funded by the government. So the same minister is writing officially to every single charity that receives taxpayers' money to ask them if there were any safeguarding issues that they should be made aware of. In other words, putting them on notice that if they have skeletons in the closet at this stage, this is the time to be clear and to make a clean breast of this, because if they don't, then there is not just a scandal, there's a scandal about a cover-up after that.
The World's Leo Hornack in London. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You know what today is. Love, chocolate, flowers, and of course, a lot of cheesy love songs. But few tunes can compete with what Thailand's prime minister has to offer for Valentine's Day, a love song to the entire nation. Talk about big love. Here's my BBC colleague Celia Hatton.
Listen to the sounds of Diamond Heart, with lyrics by Thailand's leader Prayut Chan-o-cha and vocals by a loyal Thai army officer. How many years have we gone through together? There are always new problems, the song goes. You are the inspiration that makes me fight for you. Did you know your smile is my happiness? Many in Thailand don't seem to be smiling. A YouTube version of the song has 900 thumbs up and more than 22,000 thumbs down. The comment section has been disabled, though the song was ripped apart on Twitter. People with true diamond hearts would not lie day after day and seize power from a woman, one user wrote, referencing Thailand's elected leader, Yingluck Shinawat, who was ousted by General Prayut in a coup in 2014. Many in Thailand aren't calling for new electronic music from their leader, but new elections. They've been promised, but routinely delayed.
That was the BBC's Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Coming up next, big love in Kenya for Black Panther. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Marvel's new superhero movie, Black Panther, had its premiere yesterday, not on Hollywood Boulevard, but in Kisumu, the third largest city in Kenya, and the hometown of Lupita Nyong'o, one of the stars of the film. BuzzFeed's Tamara Griffin was there, so what a treat. You got a sneak preview in Kisumu while we have to wait until Friday. So for those of us who couldn't be there in Kisumu, take us there. What was the scene like?
It was Hollywood red carpet meets African elegance, honestly. Before you even enter the theater, there was a dance troupe that was performing a lot of traditional dances to traditional music. So that set the tone right off the bat. And then as you walk past the dancers, you had more of a traditional red carpet, a big movie poster. And it's funny because Lupita Nyong'o, being from Kisumu, A lot of the marketing and the movie posters that you'd see around town didn't feature any of the other cast members. No Chadwick Boseman, no Michael B. Jordan. It would just be Lupita. So someone who knew nothing about Black Panther may be inclined to think that she was, I mean, I know she's one of the stars. They'd be inclined to think that she was maybe the only star in the movie.
She's the Panther.
Right. She is the Panther, the only Panther that matters. And so attendants would then walk past these gigantic movie posters. There was a lot of local media and some international media like myself who were there. And so they would have an opportunity to pause and take photos. There was a dress code with certain colors that people wanted attendants to wear, colors that you see a lot in the movie, golds and black, purple, mm-hmm. green, red, really strong colors. So everyone looked really, really nice. People of all ages were at this premiere, too, by the way.
It is so cool that people were up for this big moment in Kissimmee. But despite the oversized presence of Lupita Nyong'o in all the publicity, she herself was not there. Were people disappointed?
People were definitely bummed. I don't think I talked to anyone who did not express their disappointment at that. And we actually didn't know for sure whether or not she was going to be there until the day of the premiere. Some local reports had pointed to a mysterious Facebook status that I was never able to locate in which Lupita said she would be in Kisumu. And, you know, of course, on social media, it's hard to tell what's what with rumors like that. So it wasn't until the morning of the premiere, actually, that we found out for sure from Kisumu County government that she was not going to be there.
Talk a bit about mm-hmm. Lupita Nyong'o and her family and their importance in Kisumu, because her father is like the regional governor, right?
Yeah, he's the governor of the county of Kisumu. And actually, even before that, their family has had a pretty prominent place in the community. I was actually surprised to hear that in addition to his political position in the county, Anyang Nyong'o, who people locally actually call Professor Nyong'o, is also a patron of the arts himself. I learned that he, before becoming governor and entering the political space, had produced and acted in plays on his own. And so now that he's governor, he's in this really interesting position in which he's been pushing a lot of policy around arts and entertainment, cultivating that sort of community in Kisumu.
Right. So is the Black Panther screening kind of part of that strategy of his?
Absolutely. So I think apart from the obvious, you know, his connection to the film via Lupita, he saw it as an opportunity to shine a spotlight on Kisumu, not as simply the third largest city in Kenya, not for its political connections in terms of Kenyan elections, but as a place where people can go to get really rich exposure to the arts.
So I visited Kisumu once a couple of years ago. It sits on Lake Victoria from the banks of the town. It's very pretty, but I was only there very briefly. So tell us what kind of place Kisumu is.
Kisumu is beautiful, first of all. Lake Victoria is definitely one of the main focal points in the city. It's certainly very hot. I want to say temperatures were in the 90s when I was there. And in fact, the AC was not working during the premiere, so people were sweating.
That's tough.
But you couldn't tell. I mean, people totally kept their glamour despite the heat, which was actually admirable because I failed in that regard.
I got to ask you this, Tamara. I mean, you know, these comments made recently by Donald Trump about African countries and a Hollywood premiere in Kisumu at an IMAX at a big mall almost seems an intentional piece of evidence that many parts of Africa are misunderstood by outsiders. I mean, obviously, I come at this with my own American eyes, but was anybody commenting on that last night?
There was. I spoke with a very opinionated college student about this, and I was almost a little struck that she specifically referenced Donald Trump's comment. But she situated that in the context of what the movie means, not just for Kisumu residents, not just for Kenyans, but for people of African descent all over the world. I think that people in Kisumu and in Kenya in general are deeply aware of the way that their country and the way that their culture is often portrayed to the mainstream and how one-dimensional and narrow it can be. And so there were so many layers to the celebration of this film. And I think one of them was that it challenged people to confront their own biases and their own one-dimensional perceptions of what Africa is and who Black people are and what they're capable of. I heard a lot of people actually referencing Lupita Nyong'o's famous line when she won her Oscar about dreams being valid. Mm. So it was very clear that people see her both as a hometown hero, but really as this beacon of hope, specifically the local artists, you know, because they're trying to get to where she is too. And so people sort of saw the premiere of this movie in her hometown as this pushback to both Trump's comments, but also, you know, it's hard to even scroll on Twitter without seeing a stereotype about the continent. So people were almost using the movie as a shield against those problematic notions.
Tamara, what'd you think of Black Panther? And no spoilers here, okay?
Oh, absolutely not. Spoilers are a cardinal sin in my book, so I would never consider it. The film was fantastic. I thought that the plot was really thoughtfully done and political. It touched on themes that I have discussed at length with friends of mine. I love the way that they portrayed certain relationships among characters. Of course, this was a star-studded cast, but even then, there were breakout moments from actors that I was not as familiar with that I now want to know more about. I can't even think of a film that comes close to combining the plurality of Blackness in that kind of way, and it did it so effortlessly. And I think it's the kind of film that can only happen when you have the collaboration that you had. You had African actors, you had African-American actors, you had an African-American director from California. And all of those influences were, for me, deeply evident in the film. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, I can't wait to see it. Tamara Griffin with BuzzFeed telling us about the special premiere of Black Panther last night in Kisumu, Kenya. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Did I say it opens here Friday? It looks like there are showtimes tomorrow here in Boston. Anyway, for more on Black Panther, we've got a story about one of the cast members. It was a dream come true for him to get the part. And get this, he was in hiding the whole time. Catch that story on our Otherhood podcast hosted by the one and only Rupa Shenoy. Find Otherhood on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. He spoke Swedish. She spoke Finnish.
Your Finnish is very fine. There were some extra dots on an A.
It didn't matter.
Those dots on the A were so cute that I had to kiss them several times.
True love in two languages. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Spoiler alert, everyone, because I've got some Olympics results at the Games in South Korea today. Japan soundly beat Korea in women's hockey 4-1. It is the third defeat for the only team that unites North and South Korean players. Reporter Jason Strother joins us from Seoul. So this wasn't unexpected, but it was the game in which the United Korea team did score their only goal so far. I know North Koreans in the stadium were really excited by that one goal, but let's face it, the match was a loss. How are South Koreans responding to this defeat?
You know, I was watching the game with only a few dozen spectators at a plaza in Seoul. The game was being televised on a big screen there. And, you know, I think everyone thought the team did as best as they could. No one expected the women's ice hockey team to do that well. They were ranked 22nd worldwide even before the North Koreans joined the team. And I think despite some of the initial misgivings about the formation of this team, I think South Korea got over it. And one man who told me he's one of the very few true hockey fans in South Korea, Lee Sang-yoon, he told me that, you know, it was, you know, in the end, probably the right thing to do.
My initial reaction was like, what the hell is this? It's like, why we have to merge the team just like a month prior to the Olympics and not much preparation. And I mean, the players must be very upset. Because I thought, you know, politics should not be interfered with the game, the sports itself. But anyway, the decision was made and, you know, we have to accept it, move on.
There was one thing, Jason, that I was really trying to get my head around, still am. The fact that the United North South Korean team had its only goal scored by a South Korean who was born in the U.S. What were people saying about that?
Right. Well, Randy Hisu Griffin is not the only foreigner on the team. There's also a woman born in South Korea but grew up as an adoptee in the U.S. Huh. And you also have to remember that the Korean men's team has several players on it that have no Korean ancestry but became naturalized South Korean citizens so they could play for the men's ice hockey team.
What about other things that we're not thinking about in terms of how well the team was integrated, like in terms of language, training, team colors, even do they sit down and eat together?
First, they don't stay in the same building together. I went to a press conference about a week ago where the Canadian coach of the team, Sarah Murray, said that, you know, it's very unusual. The athletes aren't even staying in the same dormitory. So there, that was implying that there's not a lot of off the ice time for these athletes to bond. Language is a problem, too. The way the two Koreas speak their common language has diverged. And South Koreans use a lot of English words when talking about hockey. The words for pass, the word for goalie. There's a handful of examples. North Koreans don't use them. So they've had to use some sort of a linguistic cheat sheet to, you know, translate from one English with the coach to the way South Koreans talk about hockey to the way North Koreans talk about hockey. So there's really been a slew of complications in forming this unified team.
What about the cost, Jason? Who's paying for the North Koreans to come and play?
Well, that's a big debate happening right now here, Marco, and the South Korean National Assembly is set to debate this. North Korea seems to want the South to foot the bill, and now South Korea is deciding whether or not to pony up. The guy that I spoke to today while watching the game, Lee Sang-yoon, you know, he told me his thoughts on that.
It's like a sort of an investment, but very risky investment, because we never know how North always responds. They may, you know, test their nuke after the games, and so. But still, I think we have to do something if we wanted to risk. I mean, minimize the risk generated by the North Koreans.
So, Jason, regardless of what this United Korea exercise yields in the near term, has it been useful to have, you know, the events, the Olympics, as a distraction from all the talk of nuclear war?
You know, I think it's something that I feel, as well as many other South Koreans feel, that at the very least, and as perhaps short-lived as it is, tensions have cooled down a lot here. We're not in the same sort of downward spiral that we felt last year. It's still up in the air if the Olympics are going to lead to some kind of sustainable peace. But right now, it's nice that there's some good news coming out of the Korean Peninsula.
Rah, rah, sis, boom, bah, I think. Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Korea's hockey teams are not the only ones with foreign-born athletes. Several Olympians competing for Team USA were also born outside of this country, and several others are the children of immigrants. 17-year-old Chloe Kim, for example, that's a name you've probably heard by now. Chloe Kim made history this week when she became the youngest female snowboarder ever to win an Olympic gold medal. Kim was born in Long Beach, California. She grew up in nearby Torrance. That's where her father settled after emigrating from South Korea in the 1980s. Koreans will know this sort of story well because tens of thousands of Koreans came to the U.S. starting from the 70s through the 1990s. That was after the U.S. government loosened restrictions on immigration. Edward Chang is a professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Riverside, and he was among those who moved to the U.S. during that period.
I came in 1974. I was 18 years old. I enlisted in the U.S. Army in order to learn English language and take advantage of a GI Bill so I could get education. And that really paved the way for my future American dreams, and which I am enjoying right now.
Mm. So let's talk about the Korean immigrant experience today and how it compares to when you came here, because there's been so much written about Chloe Kim's father and his story, including this moment when, after she won her gold medal, her dad was heard chanting, "American Dream." So let me get your thoughts on that, because when her father first came to the U.S. in the 80s, he worked minimum wage jobs to save money for college and study engineering. Now his daughter is a gold medal snowboarder. Do you see a shift in how Korean immigrants themselves see the American dream?
Well, you know, those immigrants who came in the 70s and 80s, they pretty much came for two basic reasons. One, make an economic stability, economic success. Number two, education and success of their children. In terms of a Chloe Kim story, you know, he did realize American dream by making her daughter Olympic champion.
It's interesting that after her win, Chloe Kim said, I feel like I got to represent both the U.S. and Korea today. So she's kind of framing her identity as someone who can represent both the country she was born in, the U.S., and the country her parents were born in. What do you make of that?
I think that's a very important shift from their parents' generation. Korean immigrants who tend to strongly identify as a very strong ethnic Korean, whereas second and third generation, their another identity is American of a Korean descent.
And Chloe Kim's story even found its way into the immigration debate here with Congress trying to come up with an immigration package sometime soon. Let's listen to Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois. Here he is on the Senate floor. This is on Tuesday.
Let's remember, Chloe Kim's story is the story of immigration in America. Chloe Kim's story is a story of people who come here with the determination to make a better life for themselves and a better country for all of us.
Edward Chang, the Korean-American experience, now a very present piece of the dialogue here in the U.S. How significant is that historically and personally for you?
Before 1992, Los Angeles riots.
Those were the riots around the Rodney King beating, correct?
Yes, correct. And Korean-American immigrant store owners suffered about 40%, $400 million economic damage. And yet, no one really cared. And out of the ashes, the Korean-American community began to redefine themselves as a Korean-American. And we've worked so hard over the last 25 years or so to gain that visibility and access and representation and voice. And therefore, we are very proud.
I'm wondering, too, whether you think, listening to Dick Durbin, whether it's at all problematic of kind of perpetuating the model minority kind of myth.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword for us. At one hand, we are blamed for being too successful. And on the other hand, we are used as a model minority, pitting minority against minority.
Edward Chang is a professor of ethnic studies at the University of California at Riverside. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you've ever been out at sea, you probably understand the power of the wind blowing across the open water. It's that wind that sent explorers and traders and immigrants around the world for hundreds of years. And today, it's powering a new frontier in low-carbon energy, offshore wind farms. Offshore wind is suddenly booming in Europe. Much of the growth is centered in the U.K., We heard yesterday on the show about how the British government's big push for offshore wind power is quickly bringing down costs. But for a couple of old English port cities, there's another benefit. From our Livable Planet desk, here's reporter Chris Bentley.
85, 85, 85. That's the price. 280 a kilo.
Every weekday at 7 a.m., seafood wholesalers crowd into a warehouse on the docks in Grimsby in northern England to bid on yellow plastic tubs full of haddock, cod, and plaice. Today, the market will auction off some 400 boxes, or about 20 tons of fish.
We're just about break even today.
That's Martin Boyers. He used to be one of the guys buying fish, but since 2001, he's been head of the fish market and the local port. 20 tons of fish is a slow day, so the auction is over in about half an hour.
Anyway, in typical British style, it's cup of tea time now.
Not so many fish, a long tea break. It's a familiar routine here these days. Grimsby and nearby Hull used to be home to one of the largest fishing fleets in the world. But that changed starting in the 1950s. A territorial row with Iceland over the cod-rich waters north of Scotland decimated the UK's deep-sea fishing industry, and the area never recovered. It still has one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. So when Boyers and others in the port got a pitch to turn Grimsby into a maintenance hub for some new offshore wind farms planned nearby, they listened. Sort of.
I didn't know anything about renewables. I wasn't fully conversant. And to be truthful, it sounded a load of rubbish.
That was about 10 years ago.
And it's turned out to be very good for us.
Today, the waters off Grimsby are home to 7 wind farms, generating enough electricity to power more than 1 million homes. It's part of an unprecedented boom in offshore wind power in the UK, driven by a government effort to cut the country's climate pollution. And there's a lot more coming. Another wind farm under construction about 60 miles off the coast here will double the current output and eventually become the biggest offshore wind farm in the world. The developer of that project is Ørsted, it's the world's biggest developer of offshore wind farms. Just down the dock from the fish market, Ørsted's building a massive new facility to support that work. Before they came, the dock was in pretty bad shape.
Abandoned buildings, wharfages collapsing.
That's Emma Toulson. She grew up in the area and recently took a job managing community relations for Ørsted. She says by next year, the company will have put more than $8 billion into the region.
It's breathed new life back into the port, which arguably was a bit difficult to see before wind came.
Ørsted is promising 2,000 jobs during construction, 200 full-time jobs after that, and hundreds more slots for contractors to service the new wind farms. That would make Grimsby the world's largest maintenance and operations hub for offshore wind farms. Across the Humber River, the regional capital of Hull is seeing a similar boom. It's where engineers are sanding turbine blades the size of commercial airplanes in a warehouse on the waterfront. Last year, the German company Siemens set up a factory for turbine blades here. Each one is made almost entirely by hand, and so far the firm has hired nearly 1,000 people. When they're done, the blades get stacked up outside, waiting to be paired with one of the turbine towers lined up along the river and sent out to sea.
They weigh 30 tons each, so they're not easy to handle.
Barry Dines is Siemens Director of Port Operations.
And then they go on the turbine. The turbine weighs 350 tons. And then it sits on top of a tower which weighs nearly 500 tons. So these are big units.
Nearly 30 stories high, so big that they dwarf every building in Hull. You can see them from the city centre, like a new skyline at the old port.
Now, the Hull area has struggled over the last 20 years, but over the last 5 years, I think there's been a bit of a renaissance. You know, I think it's put us on the map as a place where you can do business.
These docks were built to export coal. Then came fishing. Both industries that rose and fell. And there are concerns the offshore wind boom here won't last either, especially with the reliance on European companies and the coming split from the European Union.
You know, we are in a global supply chain. It's really important to us in terms of free movement of goods.
Pauline Wade is Director of International Trade at the Regional Chamber of Commerce.
If there is a significant change there, well, that means extra cost, extra documentation, and perhaps hassle as well.
So, who knows?
Back across the river in Grimsby, Martin Boyers has his own concerns about the future of England's boom in offshore wind. He says Grimsby can't count on its luck to last forever. After all, no one foresaw the demise of the fishing industry, and the wind business is changing fast.
They might even outgrow Grimsby, and they might not come here at all, and they might change the system.
Still, Boyers isn't too worried about the future here.
People still eat fish. Even if renewables comes and goes, they'll still be eating fish.
Maybe. Climate change is putting even more pressure on many fisheries that were already shrinking. But the whole point of offshore wind is to switch to energy sources that do less harm to the climate than fossil fuels. And for now, Grimsby finds itself in the right place at the right time, for the first time in as long as most people can remember. For the world, Chris Bentley, Grimsby, England.
Chris's reporting was supported by a grant from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Tomorrow, offshore wind farms and fishing on the world. Patrick Cox is here, co-host of our podcast, The World in Words. Patrick, happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thanks, Marco. And Hoover Iste Venpäivä to you, too.
What language is that?
It's Finnish. And in just the two words that translate as happy Valentine's Day, there are seven letter A's, each with two dots like umlauts on them.
So are you linguistically celebrating Valentine's Day on The World in Words? Is that what's going on here?
Yep, we have a Valentine's episode. It's all about bilingual love in Finland. Though this is a story that actually begins far from there in Africa.
All right, that sounds really intriguing. Let's take a listen.
In 1967, a new country came into being, or at least tried to. Biafra was a part of Nigeria, and its attempt at nationhood didn't last long. War, a blockade, and starvation led to more than a million deaths. And so, 2.5 years after declaring independence, Biafran leaders surrendered to the Nigerian army. All they had to show for it was this, a national anthem. The music this anthem's based on had been on quite a tour of the world by the time it arrived in West Africa. Along the way, it had acquired words and been transformed into a hymn, several hymns. But it began its life in a place as unlike tropical Africa as you're likely to find. You can figure out where from its title, Finlandia.
Finlandia is the sort of unofficial national anthem of Finland.
Finlandia was written by the country's greatest composer, Jean Sibelius. And here's the tie-in with Biafra. When Sibelius wrote Finlandia, Finland wasn't yet a country. It was part of the Russian Empire, a grand duchy. Sibelius wrote Finlandia as a protest against that, a declaration of Finnish cultural identity. Finns fell in love with it. They're still in love with it. Most of them, anyway.
Whenever they show like old films of, you know, the World War II Finnish soldiers fighting the Russians, they have Finlandia in the background. It's sort of trite.
This is Sauli Pile, by the way, born and raised in Finland. He's in his 30s, lives in the US now. He's not a big fan of Sibelius or Finlandia until late last year when he was back in Helsinki for a visit.
It was the 100-year anniversary of Finnish independence this December. And it was the Independence Day night, and it was right next to the harbor where, you know, they have the president's castle and the city hall. And when I was waiting for the fireworks, they were playing Finlandia. And I was watching the fireworks, and I felt something. I felt like, wow, I actually did feel proud. Maybe I was just, you know, I've had a few drinks, and I felt so sentimental, but it was quite beautiful.
For many Finns, this music conveys the very essence of what it is to be Finnish. To live in a land of dark forests and hidden lakes and ice. But maybe it also just as strongly evokes the lush hills and humidity of Biafra. That may have been the genius of Jean Sibelius, to imbue his music with such a strong sense of place that two totally unrelated groups of people could lay claim to it. He had a dual nature in all kinds of ways. Like, his symphonies were both traditional and radical. Plus, he was a devoted husband and father who also nearly drank himself to death. And he spoke and corresponded with his wife in two languages, his native tongue and hers. And so it happens that their letters to each other are full of clues about how we communicate when we communicate bilingually, whether it's day-to-day chit-chat or our innermost feelings. In 1989, Helena Halmari came to the US from her native Finland to study. She's still here, a professor of linguistics now at Sam Houston State University in Texas, and a mother of three grown children. Her big academic obsession has always been bilingual communication, how people who speak two languages speak to each other in those languages.
And my own children, they were a big part of my research.
It can happen if you're the kids of academics. For years, Helena researched what might be happening when bilinguals switched languages, whether there were rules to it, not just random patterns. And then in 2015, along came the 150th anniversary of the birth of Jean Sibelius, a big deal for any self-respecting Finn. Helena started reading about Sibelius and his wife Aino. His mother tongue was Swedish, hers Finnish. He was on the road a lot, so for much of their life together, they wrote to each other. And their correspondence was now available to the public.
I started thinking about Sibelius and Aino, and I started to think, this is what they were doing. They were doing what I've been studying all my life. And there are all these letters available.
Aino was 17 when she fell in love with the 22-year-old Jean. Almost immediately, they were apart, and so began the letters.
In the beginning of their correspondence, he says, I'm writing in Swedish so that I don't have to think about every single word.
His Finnish just wasn't that good.
And he's asking, are there mistakes here? And Aino answers in the next letter, Aino answers, everything is very fine, your Finnish is very fine, there were some extra dots on an A in one word. So Aino writes, Those dots on the A were so cute that I had to kiss them several times.
Okay, if anyone suggests to you that Finns are passionless technocrats, just tell them that story.
Cute dots on an A. Yeah, I'd take that for Valentine's.
And if you listen on in the podcast, you'll hear about how this correspondence is really shining a light on how code switching works.
Wow, two for one, Valentine's Day and code switching. So check out The World in Words wherever you get your podcasts or at pri.org/language. Patrick Cox, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And that is it for us today. Happy Valentine's Day. From the whole team here at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.